Blog Talk Radio.
Phil, are you there? Sounds like we may have a problem. I'm not hearing Phil at all. Anyway, welcome to Fast Forward Radio. While we're waiting for Phil to call back in. I guess I won't do Phil's regular intro, so we'll just kind of launch into it. This week, we've got a couple things we need to talk about. Number one, Newt Gingrich came over basically and came to Louisiana and in particular to my dad's place and then we had a good time visiting with him and he had a lot to say. Phil, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Okay, great. I can hear you now.
We were experiencing just a smidge of technical difficulties for a moment there, so I assume you already told everyone that this is Fast Forward Radio and that I'm Phil Bauermaster and you're Stephen Gordon.
I didn't bother with introducing myself as Phil, but yeah, that's pretty much it.
There's this convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities that lies at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history, and this program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that pretty much be here sooner than you think. Okay, well, Stephen, I think you were in the middle of a story when I called back in, so please go right ahead.
Okay, so anyway, so I'm sitting around, having a normal Saturday afternoon, just visiting with family, and I got a call, and would it be okay for Newt Gingrich to come by? And sure. And they said, well, we need to also to allow other folks to come as well, obviously. And so at any rate, it turns into about a couple of hundred people, and.
Wow.
And it was very cool. I mean, Secret Service came over. They had to, check out the place, make sure no terrorists were living there or,
sure.
All of these candidates are protected by Secret Service, which is pretty cool. I think that's appropriate and necessary. And so they checked the place out, and then, he showed up with an entourage and everything, and, got out and introduced himself. We had a chance to chat a little bit, and then he gave a little speech. And so what we have tonight is actually some audio from that speech, and I thought it was pretty interesting, and so I thought we'd share it. Particularly, there's what I did. Obviously, not all of it would be of interest to our audience, Phil, but I picked basically three areas that I wanted to key on that I thought would be pretty interesting.
Well, I hope you caught anything he said about contraception, because Lord knows I want to have a big conversation about that this evening. If he didn't say anything, we can sure get into it. But good. I as long as we keep it relevant to the show. And also, before you play the audio, I just want to for those listening. I did not deliberately mislead with our. With our show description, Stephen and I had a conversation about what had occurred, and I misunderstood. So I thought Stephen had conducted an interview with Newt Gingrich, and in fact, you met him, and we've got audio of him. So this is more like live coverage of or recorded coverage of a Newt Gingrich event, probably than an interview with Newt Gingrich, but close
right.
enough. I mean, you're standing in the same room with him, and.
One thing I did actually prompt a subject, Phil, to be brought up. I'm sure that the moon is not the first thing. Yeah, his plan to return us to the moon, it kind of fell flat, and in part because it seemed like the Democrats jumped on it as silly or whatever, and the Republicans, I think, to their shame, did as well, and.
Yeah.
So he that's not something probably he just jumps on. But in the introduction, my father wanted to introduce him, and he looks at me and says, write up an introduction. I want to have some, you know, you keep up with these things. Write up a good introduction, and then I'll give it to introduce our speaker. And so in the introduction, I basically say, you know, Phil, he's talked about returning. You know, Mr. Gingrich has talked about returning to the moon. Bad idea. Alaska was called Seward's Folly, and you know, three people can do great things if they have, you know, great leaders. And so, you know, that was basically what I did. Oh, that's all I did. You know, was put that in the introduction to him. And so, you know, he kind of took that and went with it and began talking about it. So I thought we'd start off with that.
Let's hear it.
You pointed out, I've talked about space. My two opponents promptly assumed that I was stupid and a liberal. And they said, oh, to do that, we'd have to spend hundreds of billions of dollars. The answer is no. What you have to do is recognize that NASA's a bureaucracy. And that when you spend $181 billion in the last decade, and don't have a single rocket that can take people into space, there's something wrong with your bureaucracy. And what I want to do is trigger the private sector, create prizes, and get hundreds of billions of dollars from people in the private sector who can be entrepreneurial and innovative and cheap. The Wright brothers invented the airplane for $500. The Smithsonian had $50,000 from Congress. Their airplane went into the Potomac and sank. So I want to apply the Wright brothers model to space. But I do think if you look at the Chinese plans in space, we need to get back to some of John F. Kennedy's sense of adventure. We need to make sure that we're going to dominate the future frontier, not have the Chinese dominate.
Okay. So, you know, a lot there in that little clip there, Phil. You know, number one, I thought there at the very end it was interesting. You know, we're going, you know, we need to go back to space, and we need to do it cheaper. We need to do it with a private model. But there at the very end he said, you know, but with the Chinese, what they're doing, maybe we need to kind of be, you know, still in the space race a little bit. I thought that was kind of an interesting, aside there at the very end. But I think that's an excellent point with the Smithsonian project. You know, they had $50,000 on a more expensive aircraft attempt, and of course it didn't make it. And they took it. I went back and kind of read up on that.
I'm not familiar with this. What did they spend $50,000 doing?
Okay, they spent $50,000 in an attempt to do heavier than air flight, like the Wright brothers. Okay. This is in 1903.
Oh, this is back in excuse me. Okay, so this is back in the day.
Yeah.
All right, gotcha.
Yeah, this is back in 1903. Okay, mm-hmm. Just a month or so before the Wright brothers flew. Wright brothers flew December, I believe, of 1903, and just like a month or two before that, the Smithsonian had attempted with their $50,000 project to take off. Well, it was called the Aerodrome. Had that airplane flown, we would probably be going to the aerodrome port today. But anyway, it's the aerodrome that was an attempt to take off from a houseboat over the Potomac and then fly. And instead, it nosed down straight into the Potomac. And you know, that was the end of his attempt on that. That particular, he just about drowned. The pilot did.
Right.
And then of course the Wright brothers come in with their aircraft, which cost 100 times less, if Newt Gingrich's numbers are correct, you know, $500
right,
as opposed to $50,000, and they were able to fly, and from that, and you know, we date our, you know, a man, you know, heavier than air flight from their flight, and he's basically saying that's what we need to do with space, and he also says, and you know what else we need to do? We need to do incentive prizes. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, Peter Diamantis with his XPRIZE would smile at that, and he would also, and Elon Musk with, you know, SpaceX would smile about the you know, the idea that yes, we need to privatize. We're kind of already doing that, and you know, I think maybe one of the reasons that maybe this doesn't gain a lot of traction with voters is that we're kind of already going in that direction. You know, in a way, Obama has sort of announced that's our declared intention. So when there's not a lot of a distance between you and your opposition, it's hard to get much traction on that kind of issue. But anyway, I agree with what Nick said. I think that if folks were on the opposite side of the aisle were, you know, honest, they would agree with much of what he said too. It's really kind of non-controversial, and for that reason, not, you know, it does. I don't think it's really a game changer as far as politics for Newt. But anyway.
Well, let me take issue with one thing he said. Not that it was his position, but the position of the other Republican candidates that he was refuting. In that when he said that he wants to go into space and they accused him therefore of being a liberal, there is nothing, I think, farther from the left-right divide than this kind of issue. One of the reasons that I get really frustrated with our political process, because this is truly an issue of whether, to use Virginia Postrel's model, which I like a lot better, it's really a question of whether you have a dynamist or a stasist view of the future. That's really what's at issue. It's got nothing to do with whether you're a liberal or a conservative, whether you're on the left or you're on the right. It does have something to do with whether you think that the government should be behind, you know, should be the driver behind something or not. But wanting to go into space is, you know, is not a left or a right thing, right? I mean, it's like,
right.
John F. Kennedy got us to the moon, right? Was that do we look back on that as this great democratic triumph? You know, is that this great triumph for the left? It's this great American triumph, right? It's this great
right.
Triumph of the human spirit. It's this great advancement of humankind. So I think he's absolutely right in refuting those guys in saying that makes him a liberal. It doesn't make you either a conservative or a liberal to want to go into space. It's got nothing to do with it.
And I thought it was kind of a classy thing at the end to say we need to get some of the John F. Kennedy adventurism, you know, back. You know, we need to, you know, and maybe there's something to be said about that. Although, you know, some would say, well, that means he wants big government doing it again, and he just said private sector. So,
right.
I think we can have the John F. Kennedy sense of adventure. We choose to go to the moon. We can say that, and do it much differently the second time. You know, we can go back. Instead of it being a race, you know, to prove that, you know, we're better than a communist power or whatever, you know, we just go because, hey, we can make a bundle of money up there. You know, I mean, that's
right.
That could be the driver this time. And I think if that's the case, if we are making a bundle of money up there, we will go to stay, and it'll be a different thing this time. Instead of planting flags and coming home, we will have that moon base that he was talking about.
To give a really problematic analogy that'll get me in a lot of trouble, okay, but I'll go ahead and use it anyway. Think of the Apollo program as Columbus. All right, that was the big government-sponsored initiative that made the first thing happen, right? And
right.
Where we are now, I think, is probably opening up the frontier and settling the West, right? Which was not,
or maybe,
you know,
maybe this is the Mayflower. Maybe now,
we're ready for the Mayflower, exactly. But we're ready for this. We're ready for this ground up kind of from the ground up, I should say, not ground up as in put into a grinder, but from the ground up, individual initiative driven kind of move into space. And, you know, I think both models work. Both models have a place. But historically, I think that's where we are now, that we're in the place that Diamandis is pushing for. All right. So what else you got for us from Newt?
Okay. From Newt, he wanted to talk some energy, and he spent a good bit of time talking about it. And so let's hear from him on that.
Okay.
The last couple of weeks, I think we have begun to hit pay dirt. Because gasoline is a topic they find very hard to avoid. And we have hit a nerve at the White House. The president used his entire Saturday speech to answer me on gasoline. And they can't win this argument because their position is essentially crazy. You know, I said we ought to go back to drilling, something which, by the way, matters a lot in Louisiana. It creates jobs. It creates revenue for the state government. The president's answer, do you remember what the president's alternative to drilling was? How many of you, well, fighting tires was 2008. This year it was algae. How many of you knew he had suggested algae? So I've been developing an entire campaign around President Algae versus President Drilling. We're actually putting a poster together that shows algae, $10 a gallon, drilling, $2.50 a gallon, you know, and you pick. And I think we have begun to finally break through in a big way.
Okay.
All right. So President
Algae. What do you think, Phil? Is that fair?
You know, this is where he turns into a pure politician, right? And it's just a campaign
thing.
But I think that's completely unfair. I think that's unfortunate. I think it's unfortunate that that somebody who sees the benefits of moving into space doesn't see that we can take multiple approaches to solving our energy problems, and that something that is a little farther out. And that represents a new paradigm, it isn't necessarily a flaky idea, isn't something that necessarily needs to be demeaned. I mean, obviously he's doing it because he feels he can get political traction from it, talking about it that way. But the reality is that algae is a pretty good idea. Ultimately, I think it's very likely that if we continue running vehicles on liquid fuel, which itself is going to be determined by how good battery technology gets in the future. I think that's going to be the big driver there. Assuming the batteries never get to where they're light enough and carry enough power, and you can recharge them fast enough that it totally catches on, electrical vehicles totally catch on, we'll stick with some kind of liquid fuel. And algae is actually a powerful nano factory for creating gasoline. And when that is scaled up, it's going to prove, I think, an excellent way to produce fuel. We were talking about this last week, not just for automobiles, but for aircraft and for numerous other uses. And I don't think it's a joke. You know, whatever your position on drilling is, because I know that Stephen, for example, you're pretty much in favor of let's move ahead with drilling. And it seems like the more we hear about how much petroleum is available here in North America, you kind of go, well, you know what, if it's going to be drilled anyway, I mean, if we're going to be using gas anyway, we might as well drill our own, right? We might as well pump our own. But, you know, it really doesn't matter what you think we should be doing about drilling right now. This is a good, viable technology for the future because of its carbon neutrality. I mean, you talked about that last week, I think, did you not, Stephen?
Absolutely. And here's the deal. He said, you know, you want algae for $10 a gallon, or drill for $2.50 a gallon. I guess he could have even said it worse. He could have, and been strictly speaking, technically speaking, he could have been accurate. You want algae fuel for $1 million a gallon, because you know, I mean, that's where we are right now. You know, I mean, basically we're in the process of learning how to do this, and so that first gallon of algae fuel will be $1 million bucks, but you know what? We can scale that up, and pretty soon, before you know it, you're getting gasoline from algae factory for that's competitive with market rates. And here's the thing: Exxon believes in it. Several petroleum companies believe in it a lot, but Exxon is the one I believe that's put a huge amount of money into it, And Craig Venter is behind it, and you know, Exxon jumped in. Was it $100 million or something? It's something like that. I mean, they put a large amount of money
for sure. Yes,
a huge. You know, they heavily invested in it because they believe that hey, we can do it. Now, you know, is this going to happen right away? No, which is why we need to drill. In my opinion, we need to get our economy moving again, and energy is absolutely essential to that. So let's drill, and encourage. How about putting some incentive prizes on that algae too, and solar and everything else? You know, to me, let's do all of the above and see which one shakes out.
Right.
And because energy is absolutely essential, you know, we're a country based on ideas, you know, freedom, all this, but energy, I mean, you know, let's think pragmatically. Had it not been for the energy we had during World War II, and that Japan and Germany did not have, we might have lost that war. Energy is what powers our freedom, and we got to have a lot of it, and I think we can. So anyway, so yeah,
well, you know, if you remember years ago, we had Robert Zubrin on the show talking about his book Energy Victory, and in the analysis he gives in that book, he makes a compelling case. I'm not sure if it's 100% convincing, but it certainly gets you thinking that really all the major wars of the 20th century and 21st have been fought over gas. I mean, it comes down to oil. It comes down to petroleum. And, you know, you look at, well, what are you talking about, fascism and communism? And, you know, you start thinking about all the – and then you start looking at the actual events that occurred, and you really can make – you know, a credible, if not 100% convincing, case that has driven the wars. And yeah, I think it's an excellent point that that having access to energy is what led us to win those wars, which is why it's all the more important that to go back to my earlier point, that being forward thinking about things like energy not become a partisan issue. I would hate to have to go to the ballot box and think, okay, well, now I get to choose between whether I'm going to vote for a candidate who likes space or a candidate who's forward thinking about space or a candidate who's forward thinking about energy, because I can't have both, right? The party lines have split and decided that you know, one half is going to be interested in thinking in a future way, and that'll support this part, but not that part. And the other side is doing the other side. It's all about, you know, whether you have a dynamic and accepting of accelerating change view of the future, or whether you tend to view the future as like more of the present. And as soon as you get into that view, that's when people start deriding going into space, or that's when they start deriding taking new approaches to energy or what have you. I mean, any of a thousand different kinds of things we talk about. Now, do we have more from
actually? No, we there was a third subject that Newt covered. Now, before we leave the gasoline thing, I thought it'd be interesting to point out that President Obama was in Oklahoma today. You know, at the southern end of what would be the Keystone Pipeline, saying, mm-hmm. Yes, we want the Keystone Pipeline now. And so, you know, whether he has credibility on that issue, you know, that's for you to decide, but, you know, our audience. But, you know, I think in part because Newt has stayed in this race long past, what most people would say he has any shot at getting the Republican nomination. He stayed in the race. He's continued to harp on these issues. And I think it's actually had some effect on the other Republican candidates and, to some extent, President Obama. So, you know, good for Newt. Stay in the race. Keep bringing up some of these issues. We don't have to always agree with everything he says, but he's an interesting guy. Third thing he mentioned that I thought was interesting. I do not have the audio on because the guy that was that I got, you know, that was recording this for me. He put his finger over the microphone. It was during the Q&A, okay? And he had had a question, and he asked Newt a question, and in the process of juggling the camera, he ends up putting his thumb over the microphone, and what you hear is a lot of wah, wah, wah. So, anyway,
it's hard to get good help, isn't it? It is so hard to get good help.
Yeah. What do you do? What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
So. Anyway, I'm just going to tell you that what he did is he kind of launched into a little bit about, you know, some of the problems he had about Obamacare. And, you know, it went on and on in a rather partisan way. But he said something I thought was pretty interesting. He said, now, here's the deal. Healthcare is about to change dramatically. You guys wouldn't believe some of the science that I've been seeing. And it's going to move from a sick care model where people go to the doctor when they're sick or when they're injured or, you know, something bad's happened, to a model where people are taking care of themselves and keeping themselves in more optimal, you know, shape. And a big government bureaucracy model is not the way to go from that. You need to be, you know, this is it. You know, as with space, you need to be ground up. You need to have, a grassroots kind of thing. And technology is going to be more behind that, and is going to outpace anything that any government, you know, bureaucracy can keep up with. And I thought that was pretty awesome. And I hate it that I don't have that audio.
Well, yeah, I'd like to hear him, but we'll take your paraphrase as accurately reflecting what Mr. Gingrich said. And I think that's an excellent point. It goes in line with the idea actually of having a private driven space program. The idea that healthcare is going to become increasingly, I don't know if he talked about this, but it increasingly is moving into the realm of information technology.
He didn't use those words, but he couldn't have meant anything else.
I mean that's a big part of the transition that's happening. And of course, that's talked about at great length in Abundance, and it's something we've talked about on prior installations of this show. Is just that. Just as an awful lot of everything else has been moved into the electronic sphere, healthcare is about to be moved there. And if you go to a model where the primary focus is not remedying illness, but the primary focus is maintaining wellness, you really do go to a self-driven model. You go to this is something that individuals do for themselves primarily, so that we take care of our own health. Ourselves. I mean, at that point you don't even need a doctor, right? I mean, you know, if you're actually keeping yourself in the healthy mode, you need to, of course, people go get checked up and follow whatever if you reach a certain age, you got to, you know, get your prostate checked and all that kind of stuff. I'm not saying that people don't need to rely on doctors, but the actual process of staying well does not require an intervention. What it does require, typically, is it requires information, it requires tools, and it requires like people being kind of on top of it. And that's a huge piece of what information technology enables today. But then even when you turn that around and you say, okay, but yeah, but sometimes you have to have care. It's true. Sometimes you do have to have care. But probably 80% of that can ultimately be sourced to. Can end up being advice that is given to you through some electronic format, whether that means you're dealing with a doctor remotely, whether it means you're dealing ultimately with an artificial intelligence agent that is able to answer these questions correctly, and one that's even been moved far along enough up the value chain that it's able to write a prescription for you. Even care itself ultimately gets, to use the term that we'll be getting into in the second half of our show, dematerialized, right?
Right.
We're talking about the same kind of basic process that I talked about years ago in that post I wrote about deindustrialization, where processes and activities that once required large edifices, that once required heavy equipment, that once required a whole lot of people, that all gets scaled down to a very small number of people or no people at all in the loop, to no building or physical structure required, to sometimes no equipment required. I mean, this is the model of dematerialization that Diamandis and Kotler talk about in the book. I don't know if you saw in the appendix section of that book. By the way, for folks who haven't read Abundance yet, okay, just the back matter of this book is like the greatest stuff in the world, okay? It's like an updated version of one of my favorite books of all time. It's getting better all the time, which is nothing but charts showing how much better the world is getting. And that's what like the last, I don't know, 100 pages of Abundance is. It's just chart
more than
after
half.
Chart.
It's more than half the book. Is taken up with those charts and various appendices, and then of course end notes and things like that. But I mean, you know, you finish the book and you realize, hey, what's this back here? You keep going.
Yeah.
You
keep going. It's like, oh wow, this is pretty exciting.
Hey, can I throw in a segue real quick?
Oh sure, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, you know, just thinking, about Newt's idea. I mean, what we're talking about here, obviously, Phil, is, I mean, when your iPhone is a tricorder, a medical tricorder, and then your doctor is Watson, all of a sudden the cost of staying in pretty good shape health wise has really gone down. And here's the segue. Who's responsible for the incentive prize for the medical tricorder that's going on right now? Well,
there you go. It's the X-Prize Foundation, absolutely.
Yeah, and who is one of the authors of Abundance. So here we are talking about abundance. Okay.
Well, and in fact, that really relates to the particular graph from the back of the book that I was thinking about, this table that talks about dematerialization. And it's table number 76 in the book, page 289, for those reading along with us, which shows how with a typical smartphone today, you have $900,000 worth of applications if you use 1970s and 1980s pricing on the pieces of equipment that are embedded, mostly in software, a few in hardware form in your smartphone. What are they? We're talking video conferencing, GPS, digital voice recording, a digital watch, a 5-megapixel camera, a medical library, a video player, a video camera, a music player, an encyclopedia, and a video game console. He just took those and he took the, suggested retail price for each of those items from a time in the past when they were available, looking at something comparable, assuming that anything ever was sold that was comparable to what's available in the iPhone. And a lot of times that's not even the case. What you have today is, in fact, better in your what is it? I guess if you pay full retail for an iPhone, you pay, $500-$600, right, for that?
Yeah, maybe.
Versus about $1 million. Well, just imagine following the same kind of exponential curve that we're on when you start talking about, what if that list, instead of talking about video conferencing, GPS, digital voice recorder, what if it was talking about MRI? What if it's talking about blood pressure? What if it's talking about, all manner of medical sensing devices, all manner of medical analysis devices? Yeah, you can see all of that converging into something very small, very useful. Ultimately, I don't think there will be a separate tricorder. I think the whole thing will be a phone, right? That the doctors will be using phones with specialized apps on them, and that we'll probably be using phones on our, we'll point our own phone at ourselves in order to get a diagnosis for, what is this spot? What does this mean? Your phone will take a picture of it, and it'll upload it to Watson, and you'll get an answer back. So if Newt was talking about all that, then I think he's right on track. I think that there is I would say revolution that can occur in healthcare around this transformation, and this transformation will occur. So while we've got a political class in this country that argues about how we pay for things the way they currently exist, we've got a whole new way for them to exist coming online. So it's encouraging to hear that if no one else, Newt Gingrich is talking about it, and if he keeps talking about it, maybe some of the others will start thinking along those lines as well.
Well, Phil, you've been in a lot of situations where you kind of met someone you knew immediately was smart, right? I mean, we've had some guests on this program that were just so brilliant that it's just evident from the moment you talk to them for the first time. Newt Gingrich is one of those guys. I mean, uh-huh. Immediately, just in chatting with him, you realize, hey, this is no dim bulb. Now, I mean, it seems like from time to time he has to, he plays the political games because he has to. That's what he is. He's a politician. But it seems to me that he understands a lot of things that I think, some of the average polls may not know. And so I give him credit. I think he understands exactly what we're talking about. Anyway, thinking about smartphones, let's just list off some things that somebody used to have in their home, you know, back in, say, circa 1990, okay?
Right.
A camera, radio, television, web browser, recording studio. Well, maybe not in your home, but, you know, you'd love to have one, wouldn't you? Editing suite, movie theater, GPS navigators, word processor, spreadsheets, stereo, flashlight, board game, card games, video games, maybe medical devices, maps, atlases, encyclopedias, dictionaries, translator, textbook, you know, and maybe you're also paying for an education. You know, every bit of that, you know, is in one way or another is sort of being duplicated on the smartphone. Now, so it's those things are actually dematerialized. You know, a lot of people don't own a camera other than their phone anymore, you know.
Right.
So that device is not – is dematerialized. You don't see it in the world anymore as much. You know, the best camera you own is the one you have with you when you need a camera, you know, so, and that's likely to be your phone. And so, but it's also, in a way, some of these things have not just dematerialized, they've also demonetized because, you know, you're going to buy a phone because you need a phone, right? But then,
right.
You know, for the price of a 99-cent app, you've just replaced, perhaps, you know, a GPS navigation or something. You know,
right.
You don't have a GPS in your car. You don't really need it when you've got a, you know, you got a good map app, you know, on your.
Well, that's
your
the thing. I mean, you can spend $80 on a TomTom, or you can access your GPS app on your smartphone. And if you don't like the one that's built in, you can spend $5 for one, right? And then it's embedded in a device
that
you're carrying
that's
around.
For the real. Yeah, that's for the real expensive one. You know, there's a lot of apps are 99 cents or free, you know. So exactly. That's what we mean when we're talking about dematerialization and demonetization. And it was brought up in the book in response to something that a man by the name of Jay Witherspoon said. He said that if everybody on Earth wants to live like a North American, then we're going to need 5 planets worth of resources to do so.
Right.
Well, not if the cool stuff is dematerialized and demonetized. You know, if all these awesome things that used to, you know, require separate gadgets or separate things, you know, exist on one single smartphone that, you know, is in your pocket, then, you know, maybe we don't need 5 planets worth of resources for the cool stuff. The cool stuff is just one little device.
Well, it's this tremendous convergence of different capabilities all coming together into a smaller space. And you know, dematerialization can go a lot farther than it has. I mean, there's ultimately the thought of dematerializing ourselves, of dematerializing our environment via uploading and via virtual reality. But even if you don't take it that far, what we've seen up to this point indicates that an awful lot of what we currently think of as material wealth can be experienced, can actually be had, can be enjoyed, made use of by way of information technology. Information technology can truly provide stuff without the, you know, that we've thought of as stuff without the matter being there, without the stuff being there, or without having to pay for it. Now the question is, does that also present some risks? Does that also lead us in some bad directions? I want to read a comment from last week's show. A reader named Max, I feel he misunderstood us a little bit, but he raises an interesting point, and I'd like to talk about it in the context of talking about dematerialization. He writes, so if I understand you correctly, you're comforted by the fact that aluminum's value eventually came to be recognized and put to good use, if only some 1,800 years after the secret of its production was first discovered. Do you believe that aluminum would not have been especially useful to pre-industrial societies, or are you trying to exemplify a new kind of Pollyanna principle for the exponential age? If the glass is bone dry today, but you're certain that it will be completely full in 2 millennia, assuming that it still exists at the time, how full is it for all practical purposes? Okay, we'll come back to this in a moment. I'm just going to push. I'll just read the whole thing. Obviously, I can feel you wanting to respond to this, Stephen. I can actually pick up the vibe from here. But
so far he's got me a little confused. But go ahead.
Okay, so he says, I've been listening to FFR on and off for a year or two now, and was pleased to see the new Diamandis and Kotler book would be covered. I was hoping, and then he gets snarky, though not really expecting, a more balanced reading. Alas, it still remains for someone to seriously address the glaring critical hole in Diamandis and Kotler's story, which Kotler himself acknowledged in another podcast, perhaps it was the Singularity One-on-One, I haven't heard that one, last month, namely how the technological potential for abundance might actually be fulfilled in an economic environment that only rewards scarcity consistently and that consistently produces nothing more than the scarcity-preserving minimum, except as an absolute last resort, when no other form of competition is possible. In other words, and then he says, aluminum is a great historical example, but not, I think, in the way you suggest in the podcast, nor is the possibility of another present-day aluminum in absentia age all that remote. Just Google IPv6 from time to time over the next few years. Okay, so, yeah, he's going a lot of different directions here. But first off, he's completely misreading. I don't believe I said or hinted, nor do I think that it's a good thing that that they didn't discover aluminum 2,000 years ago, Stephen. I just want to clarify.
If I remember you correctly, Phil, you actually said that hey, it was a pretty great tragedy that we lost aluminum for a couple thousand years.
Any knowledge that we lose for a couple millennia, I would tend to think is a bad thing. I'm just going to chalk that up to a misunderstanding of, intonation on something one of us said or something like that. That's just wrong, okay? We think that was bad. And, in fact, I think that Tiberius is, in that story, an exemplar of someone who is profiting from scarcity and trying to keep a scarcity model in place because he understands it and it works for him.
He's a good example of a stasis as opposed to a dynamist.
Exactly right. Yeah, that's where it gets you in the end, right? You'll hold on to even scarcity as a reality because you can see benefit in it, even when someone's offering you like the most awesome metal anybody's ever seen. It's like no, I better hang on to what I better hang on to what I got. So the question here is, how do you get to a world that works on abundance when all of our economics has always been driven by scarcity? And one of the points I made in my response, I won't read my response back because I'd rather we just talked about this, but one of the points in my response is this is actually something we talk about all the time on the show. This is the very caution that Martin Ford throws out in his book, The Lights in the Tunnel, when he talks about basically the economy collapsing because one form of abundance, one form of dematerialization, which is the dematerialization of productivity. It's the it's this abundance of productivity that requires no human interaction. It's the same thing that I was just talking about. It's like, wow, you've got a TV studio and you don't even need the studio, right? Well, and pretty soon you don't need the cameraman either, right? That's the problem that we're potentially facing in our economy is that the same technology that dematerializes all these processes and dematerializes all this stuff and demonetizes all this stuff also demonetizes human labor and dematerializes our ability to potentially to contribute to that. That is a very real risk. And I think that there is not an immediate clear path forward to this. But far from being Pollyanna's on this, I think actually if anybody's a Pollyanna, it's me. Because as you and I have talked about this over the last couple of years, this has been a subject we come back to, I'd say at least once a month on this show, if not more frequently.
Right.
I'm of the mind that there is a path where we can make a fairly smooth transition from a material scarcity model to a material abundance model, and you're of the mind that it might be a pretty painful transition. I won't put words in your mouth, but is that where you stand on that?
Absolutely. I think that it's like we're in this child phase, and before we get to this wonderful adulthood that's ahead of us, we're going to go through a real awkward adolescence where, you know,
yeah.
we don't have enough jobs. Yeah, we've got all this stuff, but nobody has any money. You know, it's, it, you know, I think it's going to be hard. I don't see any way around it, really. We are going to just automate ourselves out of jobs for a while, and I don't see them. I don't see that trend reversing. I see it speeding up, actually. And it's not just going to be the guy on the line at GM. You know, it could be doctors that are, you know, automated out of a job when, you know, when Watson's doing a better job diagnosing us, you know.
Right.
Lawyers, too. And who knows, maybe even marketing guys, Phil. So at some point.
Yeah, they'll be the last to go, yeah.
Yeah, your job will
special.
Be the last to go. But,
oh, yeah.
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 So.
But it's absolutely true. You know, if doctors and lawyers can be automated, right, there's no function that can't be automated. I mean, there's no function that can't there's nothing that people can do that can't ultimately be done by a machine. I think that there are some things that we'll keep doing for quite a while until robotics becomes really viable. I don't know if you saw that video that's bumping around on Facebook of the guy getting his hair cut by a robot.
No, I didn't.
because it's like everyone's talking about how brave he was, and the final comment is he wasn't badly hurt, right? I mean, this is the best thing. It's not like he was really badly hurt, okay? No one's saying, right? No one's saying, hey, what a great haircut, right, or anything like that. So I mean, there is this
scars will heal.
There is this period where, you know, I think. Basic clinical functions are going to be done by increasingly by data centers, by nurses, by who knows, by outsourced doctors in the developing world, ultimately by AIs. But really fine surgery might still require a human doctor until robotics gets quite a bit further along. So there's certain functions that we're going to be very slow to pull.
I completely disagree, Phil. I've got to disagree with you.
Okay, go ahead.
Surgery's already gone robotic. On many different types of surgery, robots are able to work at a finer level than people are. And I mean, for example, if you were to go have your eyes fixed so you didn't have to have glasses, that's almost entirely robotic now. There's other types of surgery that's almost completely robotic as well. And of course. You know, major surgery like a knee replacement, you know, where they have to, you know, hammer that, you know, artificial knee into place. Of course,
right.
That, it'll be a while coming, but we're talking about little fine-grained, tiny surgeries that with just small incisions, you know, arthroscopic. Those surgeries are going robotic very quickly.
Well, they're going robotic, but correct me if I'm wrong, but this is a human-robot collaboration, right? At least for the immediate future. There's still a doctor somewhere around while that's going on, right? I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah.
When the guy got his hair cut, he sat down, and the thing closed over his head, and it tried to cut his...
cut his head off, huh?
Yeah, you know. No, it tried to cut his hair. But the point is... There's still people in the loop. Even if you're getting the very fine detailed robot portion coming in, probably whoever's opening you up is a human, and who's closing you is a human. And if something weird happens in the middle of it, there's a human being stepping in. But this is actually, we digress, because it doesn't matter whether surgery is quickly going to be automated or whether it will be one of the things. But my actual point is that. That we will trade one form of scarcity for another. It's not that the economy even needs to switch to a model other than scarcity. It could be that scarcity is ultimately the thing that drives economic activity. Maybe you always have to have scarcity for economic activity to occur. But if that's the case, then what we'll be dealing with is the things that are scarce. And if material things are abundant, then and even information is abundant, and even the ability to create information is abundant, then it will simply be other things that that becomes scarce. It'll either be very unique interactions that individuals can have with information, that is to say, highly specialized products or highly specialized experiences that people can provide for each other, or we base an economy on something completely different. And this is where our discussion that occurred the same, what was it, a week after or a week before when we talked to Martin Ford, which was our discussion with Cory Doctorow, and we talked about, you know, can you base an economy on reputation? You know, can you base an economy on something like how well known a person is, how well respected a person is, what level of credibility a person has accomplished? Well, we don't know how we get to there. I don't know how that transition is done smoothly, but I can picture it occurring. Right? I can picture it occurring. I can say, well, we can imagine ourselves living right now in an economy that is essentially 100% monetary, to one that maybe next year is one that's 98% monetary and 2% reputation, right? Or maybe at some point 50-50, and ultimately the money just kind of falls out of the bottom, and reputation becomes the piece of scarcity that enables economic activity to continue to occur. Maybe it will have to be a painful transition. My point is just that maybe not. That there might be a smooth way of getting from one place to the next.
Well, I hope you're right. I this is one that I definitely would prefer to be wrong on. I'll happily tip my hat to you if you turn out to be right and I'm wrong on that one. So it's, you know. I think we pretty much have beat that one. Just thinking, as far as jobs go, I mean, like you said, marketing may be one of the last ones to go. I guess the closest.
I really don't. I really don't believe that. By the way,
With marketing, let me just think about this. With marketing, okay. you have to have your finger on the pulse of pop culture. To some extent, if you're going to market something, and you know, it helps to know that. I think that might be one of the last things that machines do well. I'm not saying that they won't do well at it at some point. I'm just saying as far as being a good lawyer. I mean, you could put all the law books in the United States in a data system and have it cross-referenced in some way and it's up an intelligent system that might actually do pretty well. And Watson, I think, will make a pretty darn good doctor within just a few years. I mean, within 5 years. I'm thinking that might be one of the last things to go. So, that might be my second career, Phil. I'll, network with you a little bit when the time comes.
Well, the great thing about going into marketing is, don't tell anybody I said this, okay? Luckily, no one's listening to us, but there's no more qualifications, right? Anybody can – I never studied it. Anybody can claim to be a marketing expert, and as long as nobody ever calls you on it, you're fine. So,
I'll just show up with a clipboard and a confident air.
I think if you showed kids – if you took, like, 8, 9, 10-year-old kids and showed them what marketing people do primarily, they would look at it and go, well, that's just made up. Your job is just made up. I think that would be the response. I hope my boss isn't listening to this, actually. That would be unfortunate. But actually, it's that aspect of it that makes it difficult for – it's going to be hard for machines just to make something up, you know, just to go, well, we don't do this, we do this. So actually, it's this. Well, actually, it's more like, it's more like this. That sort of make it up as you go along aspect of what marketing is and what it has to be, but especially in the markets we deal with today, to your point, probably do make it one of the things that'll be harder for machines to pick up. But one reason I think that we can be optimistic about this is that we do see a transition from people doing things to machines doing things that occurs fairly fairly smoothly. We've seen a lot of other transitions that have occurred fairly smoothly. Transition to a totally data-driven economy happened without anyone going, no, we can't handle this. We'll never do this. I mean, it was a tough transition for some, but by and large, the opportunity associated with it so outweighed the difficulties that that we made that transition in a fairly smooth way. Looking back, we say, glad we crossed that hurdle, and it's nice to be here. But anybody's guess as to how much trouble we're going to go through getting there. One thing we can agree on, having read Abundance and long before we ever read Abundance, it'll be worth getting there. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
I think we can agree on that. And I don't know if we're out of time, Stephen, or if you have one more parting thought.
I think we're pretty much out of time at this point. And if we start the music now, the chat room will actually get to hear it tonight. So it wouldn't
They'll
be a bad
get to hear
idea.
The entire music. So
yeah,
that's probably worth it. All right. Well, what is our music this evening, Stephen?
Me and Carlos by Jeff Rone.
Me and Carlos by Jeff Rone. Now, is there any tie-in between this piece of music and Newt Gingrich or dematerialization? Or?
You know, I looked far and wide for Newt Gingrich music and did not come up with a single tune. So, you know.
It's too soon to play the Snooter one again, I think. So.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, still appropriate. But
I think, we could play Awesome Alfreda. Alfreda, that's a Georgian, that's a Georgiatown, I think.
We've used that one a couple times, though. Yeah, I like this. I'm sorry. Give me the title one more time.
Me and Carlos by Jeff Rone.
Okay, Jeff Rone sings Me and Carlos. All right. Well, thank you for putting that together, Stephen. And thanks for bringing Newt Gingrich onto Fast Forward Radio. That was really cool. Thanks to everyone listening, those of you listening live and those listening via MP3. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. Great chat that went on tonight in our chat room. Thanks for being with us, friends. We will be back at the regular time next week with an all-new show. Hope you'll be able to join us. And until next time, live to see it.
I got an email from my sister last night. She told me write a song that makes people feel something. Deep down inside. But I don't know how to do that. I do not know where to begin. So I just pulled out my guitar and started walking down the neck again. It sounded something just like this. Maybe a little bit like Mr. Santana. Okay, maybe more than just a little bit like Mr. Santana. Okay, it sounds a hell of a lot like Mr. Santana. But is that really such a bad thing? I mean, it's... Okay, let me start all over with the piano thing again. Here we go. I got a brand new melody. I think it just might make you feel like something's happening deep down inside. Maybe I know how to do that after all. Maybe I know where to begin. So let me pull out this guitar and just start walking down the neck again. Carlos never did was a finger solo, a finger snapping solo, which I'm going to feature right now in my song. Everybody, snap your fingers out there, radio man, come on.
Deep.